of a very humble, a very gentle, and a very retired nature. But here again, we have to divide our path between what can be historically demonstrated and that which falls distinctly under the level of tradition. About the 16th century, or the last part of the 15th century, a great Jewish book appeared in Europe, which was to have a profound effect upon the thinking of the Jewish people. And that was the Sefer HaZohar, or the Great Book of the Splendors. This book was completely and almost entirely mystical and allegorical. It was the tremendous expansion of every prophetic and extrasensory experience of the Jewish people. This work is supposedly, or is attributed, at least by legend, to Rabbi Simeon ben Yochai, who lived during the reign of the Emperor Vespasian. He was exiled, cast out, and a Christ was placed upon his head by Rome. And he retired to a cave in the wilderness. And he had no clothing but earth with which to cover his body. And there he remained alone in meditation. And gradually drew a few disciples around him, and there in hiding he received the spirit of prophecy and the presence of the Lord was with him. And Simeon ben Yochai compiled this wonderful work, which is called the Books of the Greater and Lesser Holy Assemblies and the Related Matters of the Zohar. This book had a very deep and moving effect upon Jewish thinking for a great many centuries. And although it was never regarded as an orthodox work, it shared with the writings of Rabbi Akiva a great deal of prominence and popularity. It again was the pressure on toward the purely mystical. Now we can parallel this also in the rise of early Christianity, because during the period of the great persecution of the Christians, we find also the rise of a great mystical concept. A mystical concept which was again revived in the decadence of Christianity during the Dark Ages. So when Christianity began to develop a bad conscience, it did exactly the same thing that the Jewish prophets had done earlier. And from the 12th to 14th centuries in Europe, there were men, prophets, walking up and down the countryside year after year, crying out that the punishment of the Lord was at hand. And in some parts of Europe, flagellant groups developed that wandered from one country to another, lining the roads with the bodies of the dead and the blood of flagellants. And during this great period of repentance, it is quite probable that several hundred thousand persons beat themselves to death out of fear. Out of fear that they had offended God. And their consciences were just bad enough for them to have some ground for that anxiety. But out of that anxiety came also the great cry that we heard at the beginning of the Christian year, voiced by John the Baptist in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord and make his path straight. Repent your sins and give yourself to truth from God. The prophets of the 8th century B.C., faced with the captivities and exiles, cried this. Those of the 1st century A.D. cried the same. Those of the 12th century cried again. And now in the 20th century, we hear whispers of another cry rising. Namely, that the human being who passes through these periodic revulsions against his own mistakes and resolves in some tremendous effort of his own spirit to restore that which he has forfeited, destroyed, or compromised by his own misconduct. The possibility that such restoration is possible, that it can be accomplished, that it may be done, also, of course, is the great open hope which lies in most of the prophetical thinking of ancient people. And we have to see it a little bit as to what the concept of this better world to come really was like. If we follow one Jewish line of thinking, we come to the millennium, or the golden age, the age of truth and peace for which all men long and yearn within themselves, especially as they suffer here. The rulership of this state is in the hands of the Messiah King. Now the Messiah King of the prophets, the Jewish prophets, is not essentially different from the philosopher king of Plato. In fact, there is some indication of borrowing by the Greeks from the Semitic tradition of that period of time. The Messiah King, or the Philosopher King, is the king who rules in the righteousness of God. who rules as the servant of God, and whose government and reign are completely dominated by the Torah, or the law. And he rules over a people who in their own hearts have been restored in faith, therefore that they live together in peace and happiness and security. So in the earlier pictures we get some concept of this. We get the dream of the day to come, when the lion and the lamb shall lie down together, and the little child shall lead them. We get the concept of a great security in which every creature in nature, more or less, combines in a fraternity of brotherhood and love. This is the golden time we look for. This is the golden age of the prophets. And while they conceived it largely as the reward of Israel, even their own best thinkers have been prone to regard it as a symbol of a collective good for all mankind. A good in which men shall outgrow evil and shall outgrow sin and death, the last great enemies of men and all the time. To achieve this, there is only one possible way, and that is through witnesses and through the testimony of the Spirit. Now, the prophets were witnesses, and they bore evidence to the fact that man can know. That was one of their primary duties. Their prophetic statement was that because man can know, he must and will know. This was the inevitable outcome of the basic concept. So we find the testimony and the arrival of the concept of the scapegoat. And we find it fitted into this messianic picture or pattern. Men must deserve the golden age. We cannot be deserved for them. The Jewish concept does not, as I understand it, basically conceive of the forgiveness of sin. In other words, it does not conceive that salvation is by forgiveness primarily. Salvation is by good works. The individual must not just be sorry for what he did wrong. He must do what is right. He must earn by the positive statement of his ability to perform constructive action, even at the expense of pride and self-will. Thus, the coming of the golden age must be through the people. It must be because the average human being in his heart has learned to love the law. And this, more or less, coincides, for example, with the concept of the golden age or the coming millennium in Buddhism, in which the Bodhisattva Maitreya used to appear as the blessed and desired of all nations. And the same concept occurs in Islam, with the advent of Ahmed, the beloved of all peoples to come. Thus, the advent of the Messiah implies, in the mind of Israel, that there shall be a worthy kingdom over which he shall rule. In other words, he is not going to come and bring order out of chaos. He is not going to come with a sword in one hand and a book in the other, and perhaps with force or with great power cause this reformation. He is not going to stand in clouds of glory so that no one will dare to disobey him. He is not going to come with the flail of the crook of the ancient Egyptian hierarchy. He is to come for the throne that has been prepared for him before the beginning of the world. He comes to the throne of David, which man himself has built. Therefore, there can be no golden age until men have merited the coming of the Messiah King. This meriting is not to be individual. And we move the entire concept of human society onto a different level. In Israel, the original concept was that there is no salvation for the Jews. There is a salvation only for Israel. That the individual achieves not for himself, but for all. And he fails not for himself, but for all. In other words, the weakest man in Israel is the failure of Israel. In the by distinction also, the strong man in Israel contributes something to the strength of all Israel. Thus, the virtue of the good man does not save him, but contributes to the common good of all men.
And it was inconceivable, apparently, at the time of these prophetic writings, that any individual could go to heaven and enjoy himself, knowing that everyone else was not there. This was a very interesting point. In other words, we had an epidemic of theology at one time in which it was actually taught by dear old Jonathan Edwards, one of our real hellfire and damnation preachers of New England. The family would love to stand up on the bridge of heaven and watch their loved ones screaming in purgatory below, and they would be, and the ones above would be singing hymns of praise to God. Well, this does not fit into the messianic concept of the old prophets. They could not conceive of this. Perhaps it was because of the peculiar clannishness of the people. Perhaps it was because they had suffered together so much. But their concept of suffering together implied their hope of enjoying it together. It was a communal thing rather than an individual thing. And the peace of man was to be a collective peace, because no man could have peace if others did not. He could not find any satisfaction in being the one good man in the world. He could not find any happiness knowing that those whom he loved, or even those whom he did not know, still suffered in ignorance. This, incidentally, is a very deep mystical tradition, and it finds itself, of course, well stated in the northern or Mahayana school of Buddhism, where the Bodhisattva renounces the Nirvana and takes the oath of the great sacrifice, in which he affirms that he will not enter into peace until the least of creatures can go with him. This is also an essential part of the old messianic concept of the kingdom of Israel to come. Namely, that it must be all the people. That it must be the fullness and happiness of Israel. But that this happiness is made possible by individual actions. That this happiness needs sharing. And even the old prophet said something that we haven't realized much today, and that is, competition is not the life of trade, it is the death of the trader. Cooperation is the life of trade. It has interfered with a temporary passing concept of the prophet system as we know it today. Actually, the advancements of all great causes must be through common effort. And certainly the cause of wisdom, of truth, and of reality are great causes. And these causes depend upon the greatest possible human united effort. So in this concept, we find that the growth of the individual is tied closely with the growth of the total group. For instance, the idea of sharing and giving is very strongly present in most of the old Orthodox Jewish communities. They gave of what they had. They had a ritual in which a living man gave a day of his life or hours of his life to another in order that that other person might live longer. They actually had rituals for that purpose. It was a part of their concept that in some mysterious way each one could give to the other. In the messianic way, then, of this approach, the salvation lies in the regeneration of the total humanity. And this regeneration of the total humanity can only come as a result of man's personal experience of the immanence of God. This total experience, as even the old prophets realized, is difficult to man in prosperity. Therefore, this became the justification for the great adversities of the people. It was evident that in their troubles they came together. In their troubles they found generosity, they found friendliness, they found sharing, they found sacrifice. And in a strange and mysterious way, for the glory that shone through tribulation, and made tribulation more wonderful, more beautiful, more real in the great joy and security. This follows naturally in the thinking of the people even now. And the dream of the better day to come, while it differs with different sects, still I think it is probably rather well summarized in the findings or opinions or the platform set out by the liberal and reformed Jewish rabbis in this country in 1937, when they stated that it was their historical task to work together with all men of good principle and good hope for the restoration of the peace, the sharing of all good things, fellowship, friendship, and mutual esteem and regard, and that this labor together must end finally in the fulfillment of the messianic purpose. So that the messianic purpose in Israel is the purpose of man building a godlike world, and that when he has built the temple according to the law, the living God will dwell therein, and that when man has built a society worthy of the presence of truth, truth will come and live in it. The truth will not save him in his errors, but truth will crown him in his virtues. That he does not use truth to escape ignorance, but uses or receives truth when he himself has overcome ignorance, as has restated the great essentials of life. This, while we may or may not agree with it completely, is certainly a very noble, very positive, very constructive attitude for the mysteries of life. We should also bear in mind that while the legends are comparatively inadequate, and we must depend very heavily upon something which I have tread upon with great reservation, and that is interpretation, that there was, traditionally, a body of knowledge which paralleled the general teaching of the people, even as far back as the time of the prophets. This is quite conceivable, inasmuch as it is assumed that Moses was learned in the wisdom of the Egyptians, and very definitely may have been aware of the Egyptian secret systems of education. He had been adopted into the household of Pharaoh, which gave him advantages and would have made him eligible to the mysteries of the priesthood. We know, for example, the Ark of the Covenant was patterned almost exactly from the Egyptian Ark on the carved walls of Baiae in Egypt. We know also that a great deal of the prophetic writing is based upon the earlier Egyptian records. And there is every reason to assume and support that there was a division of knowledge among the Jewish people, and that certain knowledge was available to certain groups, even as much as in the caste system of India, of ancient India. By this we know that the tabernacle of Israel was divided into three rooms, or three parts, of which the outer was the outer court, where the people of the 12 tribes would gather and bring their offerings to the altar of burnt offerings, or bring and place their dinners in the labor of purification in the courtyard of the tabernacle. This place was therefore the symbol of an outer world, and to a great degree it was the symbol of the Torah, the body of the law. Then there was the holy room, the larger and outer department or compartment of the tabernacle itself. The outer room contained the altars of the shewbread, and it also contained the seven-branch candlestick. And here was also at the rear, and dividing this room from the sanctum sanctorum of the Holy of Holies, was the altar of burnt incense, upon which, or from which perpetually, a pleasant aroma unto the Lord ascended. This room was accessible to the priests, and here we have the room of the second doctrine, which was the Mishnah, or the soul of the law. The Holy of Holies, or the inner place, which contained the Ark, the cherubs, and originally was supposed to have within it the tablets of Moses and the budding rod of Aaron. This wood, this mysterious box of Shechem wood, overlaid with gold and carried upon staves in the wilderness, was the mercy seat, or the place of the Shekinah's glory, where the Spirit of the Lord hovered. And here only the high priest of Israel could enter. And before he was permitted to enter this room, he must remove all the garments of glory, for he might not wear any ornament, decoration, or symbol of temporal authority or power in the presence of the Lord. And before he could enter this room also, he had a rope tied to one foot. So that if when he entered into the holy place, there was an evil thought in his heart or mind, and God struck him dead,
his body could be drawn out of the room by the rope, because no one else could enter to take it out. This Holy of Holies, therefore, the abode of the cherubs, whose wings met upon the mercy seat, was certainly to be compared to the most secret and hidden mysteries of Israel. And to the Kabbalists of the medieval period, this was the Kabbalah, or the unwritten law. The law which belonged only to the Hasidim, those who had received the mysteries that had been advanced in the secret arts and sciences. Later, this law and the wonder of it was said to have been passed into the keeping of Solomon, King of Israel, who became master of the world, who became master of the spirits and of demons and of all the mysterious creatures of nature. There are many legends relating to this in the Arabian Nights entertainment. But there were the vestiges of these three levels of doctrine and belief. And we know without any grave doubt that the deepest and darkest and most mysterious of these doctrines dealt with man's internal disciplines, the ways in which he could be brought into a conscious identity with the mystery of God. These secret teachings were reserved not physically for the high priest of Israel, but mystically for those who had been anointed, who had received the call, and who had known that they were taken out of the world to become the servants of the living Spirit of God. Thus, even at the time of the prophets, we may be quite certain that none of them is involved in this writings. And that these writings, therefore, have a larger context than might first and originally appear. If, therefore, we do join a little bit with the mystical speculations of the Jewish and Christian Kabbalists of the medieval period, and try to unfold a little according to their concept some of this esoteric phase of the matter, we should not be held as differing in spirit from the great students and scholars from among the Jewish people themselves. For all of these things were part of their way of speculation and of life. The darkest or most hidden parts of this speculation, therefore, dealt with the release of man's spiritual power. Really dealt with the creation of the God-man. And in the case of Israel, the representation of this was enlarged. We had in the medieval period a system of doctrines, of interrelated beliefs, which referred to a macrocosm and a microcosm. This theory went out of fashion with the development of modern science, but it has still been cherished as a part of old mystical speculation. In this doctrine, there are two worlds, the great world and the lesser world. The great world is called in the Zohar the macrocosmos, or the great face. And the lesser world is called the microcosmos, or the lesser face. And these are the two faces of God, the superior and the greater face, and the inferior and the lesser face. In the development of the concept, man became identical with microcosmos, or the lesser face. Man, in other words, was the miniature. Man was the small concentration of the entire divine mystery. So as the old mystics used to sing, these three books by which man may know the universe. The first is his own body. The second is Holy Writ. The third, the universe itself. These were the three ways or three books by which man could read the mystery of existence. Now, microcosmos, or the macrocosm, was always the collective. And we think a great deal of how God made man in his own image. We think a great deal of how the universal energies, resources, and powers are focused upon man, so that he possesses within him the infinite potential of all knowledge and all power and all good. The Jewish mystics seem to have followed an inclination of that and reversed the process. In other words, instead of thinking of how much man has received from God, the Jewish mystics take the attitude that the microcosm represents the individual and the macrocosm represents the collective. In other words, that the individual and the collective are bound together by this strange and mysterious tie. That all things that exist in particular in man exist in general in all mankind. And and that therefore it is not necessary that man should bear witness to the collective, but it is also possible that the collective can bear witness to the individual, which is the alternation of the polarity of the perspective. Therefore, it is the collective that bears witness, and this collective being the work of men, considered as a totality. The collective forming the great environment in which the individual exists and with which he must make his adjustment and to which he must pay a strange, mysterious devotion, regardless of its limitations or its inadequacies. Thus, the power of deity, being universal, is reflected downward into the most universal concept of man possible, and that is the collective. This collective, in the Jewish thinking, undoubtedly gradually becomes identified with Israel. Israel is not a nation any more than Adam is man. Israel is the collective. It is man. Even as Adam represents the primogeniture of the universe. Adam is a plural word, meaning the species, the kind, or the type. A creation. Adam Kadmon, a creation formed of the red mist of space. In the collective, then, we have the concept of Israel as a being. Israel first as a patriarch, then Israel as a nation, and finally Israel as the world. Therefore, the salvation of Israel is the salvation of the world. The tragedy of Israel is the tragedy of the world. And this tragedy implies a great deal that many individuals should think about. It is the tragedy of what we term a motion temporally successful and ethically a dismal failure. It is a motion in which man, seeking his own advancement as an individual, has sacrificed the collective, which is the symbol of God among men. Here we can go right back to Oriental thinking again. You have a perfect parallel of it in the Vedanta system. On one occasion, the Swami Vivekananda was once observed to be weeping softly, and someone asked him what was wrong. He said nothing was wrong with him, but that he was just sharing in the sorrow of another who was his other self, and that he had experienced within himself the pain of a person he did not even know. This concept would be very consistent with this idea, this very strong, positive, and rather cataclysmic idea. Namely, that the proper symbol of God in society is not man, but society itself. That God is not just one. God is one in many. Man thinks of the oneness of God as being focused into himself as one. But God is infinite, and the collective becomes the best and most natural symbol of infinity. Thus we have the tremendous need of the individual to keep faith with God by keeping faith with the collective, not just keeping faith with himself. If he keeps faith with the collective, he cannot break faith with himself. We find the same thought again in Kant's categorical imperative, which he more or less advanced as his concept of a reformation of the golden rule. Namely, that every man should so conduct himself that if every other man behaved in the same way, everything would be good for all. In other words, he restored the concept that an individual should conduct himself in such a manner that if it was collective conduct, it would be good. This throws the weight to the collective again, you see. If the individual who injures the collective injures both himself and his God. That the security of the collective is indispensable to the security of the individual. Here we come down to some rather solid political thinking. And we come to a problem that is being divided and torn today. Namely, is man created for the state? Or is the state created for the individual? Now, in our democratic concept, we believe that the state is created for the individual. But in the dualistic concept, we would be asked to think this through. Not necessarily in the terms of the individual becoming the servant of the state,
and being dominated by some tyrannical despotism on a political level, certainly not that at all. But is the individual made for his own good and his own good only? Is he made to live and die, hope and fear, save himself or lose himself, as a single unit within a construction, and with no responsibility to the rest, other than such responsibility as he may voluntarily choose to assume? Is he created under a system in which the purpose of the state is to create an environment suitable for his happiness? Or is he created with a responsibility to create a state suitable to his own good? You see, we get into a rather dangerous point here, and yet we get into a very fundamental point of rabbinical law. And I don't think we could entirely disregard the position of the Jew, the philosophical position, if we approach it on a level comfortable with his thinking. If we approach it on a strong political level, we would certainly differ with him markedly. But if we recognize that the increasing growth of man is witnessed by an increasing value to all, I think we have a very valid position. In fact, we have a position that the man of good spirit almost instinctively assumes. Very few good people are satisfied simply to be good, or to hope for their own salvation through goodness. In fact, the more and more it becomes a moral duty of the individual to share good, and to serve in any way possible the common needs of his fellow men. I think we can note this in our public life today. But I think it is particularly noted in the Jewish community, where there is a tremendous determination to preserve the unity of the people and to take care of the problems which arise within that community and to take care of them adequately. This is an important point because it again emphasizes the fact that the individual exists for the common good, not as the servant of others, but as the server with others, for principles upon which the state itself must stand. This, Carl, follows another point, and it's a very good point. And that is, namely, can the state reform the individual? Can the state force good laws to make good men? Can the state become so sufficiently prosperous or so abundant in everything that all men will be good? Can the state remove so many problems that man without problems will be happy? The old congregation of Israel said, no. An individual that cannot be made happy in this way. And Maimonides also told something, that happiness comes from within. It comes from the individual realizing not his opportunity alone, but that opportunity is his responsibility and vice versa. Therefore, that his happiness lies in seeing the common good flourish around him. Because under this common good, his own security is inevitable. Whereas if he thinks only of his own security, he will place himself in a civilization of unregenerate beings so completely inimical to him that he cannot be secure, no matter what he has. This all has a bearing upon our subject because it restores to us the concept of the final messianic dispensation and what it means. It brings all of the teachings and writings and beliefs of the prophets in sharp focus of the termination of this great cycle in which the diaspora is over and the peoples return again from confusion to faith. The scattering of Israel is the scattering of man's spiritual resources. It is a division within himself in which his principles become hopelessly lost in exile servitude to his own ambitions, his selfishness, and his tyranny. The diaspora then represents the good in man, broken up, scattered throughout the world, to spring up here and there and elsewhere, but to be forever in exile, to be ever under the tyranny of false monarchs and of foreign kings and rulers. It is the evidence that in man, and in the great community of man, there is that chosen goodness, that spiritual electness, locked within the human heart, locked
within the pattern of selfishness and self-centeredness with which we have tried to satisfy our religious and our material requirements. Thus, the diaspora is, of course, something that is the final punishment of a selfish man, that he must be alone, that he must be in exile. For as the prophet himself points out, the end of the evil man is that he must be alone. He must endure himself. And this is the heaviest punishment the flesh can bear. This is why the ignorant and the foolish, the selfish, do not like to be alone. That they fear their own company even more than they fear the condemnations of their fellow men. So out of the loneliness of ignorance, men must come back again to the fraternity of wisdom and truth. And I think there is considerable to be said here in connection with the use of the term wisdom, as we find it in the Catechism and in many other of the Jewish writings. Wisdom in this sense does not mean what we use today as wisdom. It does not mean great learning of the mind or great scholastic attainment. Such things were not even available in those days. Wisdom meant more to these people that innate a sense of realities, which we find still among the primitive people and among the simple directness of those who are simply good. Wisdom is therefore the inner insight which impels the individual to live well. Wisdom is an understanding in the heart by which the person is called in his natural destiny, called in the fulfillment of his own spiritual purpose, and in the fulfilling of it, called in the service of his people. Citizenship, as in most other ancient nations, implies among these people a sharing in a burden. It was not something that was something that bestowed privilege. It bestowed duty. It made the individual a mature part of society on the ground that every mature individual is responsible for the collective good of the order of life in which he lives. It is his duty, if necessary, to sacrifice himself completely to the perfection and maintenance of that better order. And it is his duty also to continue to build that order from within himself, and not by the accumulation of outward things alone. Thus, the messianic dispensation is not a period in which men are suddenly relieved of their troubles. It is a period in which individuals who understand can live together in understanding. Therefore, the beginning of the messianic dispensation is when two persons can share their realities together. There can be no dispensation without sharing. The dispensation is not what either one of them possesses. The dispensation is that which comes in the sharing and is brought into existence by the mingling and the union of dedicated and enlightened lives. Thus the dispensation is not born by men, the dispensation is not carried by individuals, but by their association with each other. Pythagoras points this out on an astronomical level in his discussion of the music of the spheres. He says music is not caused by the motion of the planets, but by the intervals between them. Thus, music harmony or inharmony in society is not due to the bodies of society, but to the relation of their intervals. And in this case, the interval is the distance between one person and another. The bridging of this interval with an harmonious accord creates the music of the spheres and also creates the concept of the earthly paradiso. Thus it comes into birth as a result of union of lives. No one can bring it, no one can destroy it, but all may know it. In this concept, then, the messianic mystery is the revelation of this relationship, of this integration which comes between dedicated lives. In the old Jewish beliefs, there is a teaching that children come into the world as a result of the overlapping of the magnetic fields of the parents and unless the order of the father and mother meet and overlap, there is a neutral zone between the parties overlapping. And in this zone of quietude, the child is born. And this zone of peace, where positive and negative, the magnetic field neutralized to form a perfect quietude, a perfect peace of life. In this interval, the life itself is able to enter into manifestation or to come through the great peace into objectivity. There is quite an elaborate doctrine relating to this in these various but here is the secret of their concept of the messianic dispensation. Wherever two or more are gathered together in the name of truth, that truth shall abide in the midst of them, nor can it be absent. When two or more are gathered together in the name of God, God is strangely and mysteriously present. Not in either, but in the mingling of the two, in the union of the separated elements of a spiritual nature. Thus the Messiah, or the desire of all nations, is mysteriously brought into existence in the zone of the great peace which comes upon the congregation of Israel under the Messianic concept. Where these gather together in a great peace in their hearts, and their spiritual fires, like the Pentecostal flame, burn brightly in the mysterious inner atmosphere of the faith, they form of their own natures and of their own complete consecration a great zone of peace. And this great zone of peace is the Golden Age. It is the place where the millennium comes into existence. And it is in this zone of peace that the messianic power of God is revealed to his people. Therefore, as the prophets have pointed out, the requirements of God in these matters are clear and simple. That wherever men shall worship in his name, they shall abide in peace one with another. For if they cannot be at peace with their brother whom they have seen, how can they be at peace with their God whom they have not seen? And that no man receives the dispensation. The great peace receives him. And this great peace is called the congregation. And later in Christendom, this congregation was represented by the Ecclesia, or the Assembly of the Just, as it is called. In the ancient symbolism of Apocalypse, we find it in the 24 elders who kneel before the throne above the great sea of glass, forming of themselves a circle of light. As you probably know, there has been considerable talk and discussion of the possibility of what has been called the British Israel Movement. The idea that the British people are part of the lost tribes of Israel. There's been considerable discussion of that. And in the recent coronation of Queen Elizabeth, there was a revival of interest because of certain parts of that coronation ceremonial, which certainly goes back to the Melchizedekian rites, the anointing of the head with oil, the passing on of the strange power of kingship, seated on the throne with a stone of thorn, which was the pillar of Jacob, and all the mysterious symbolism of this kind. But perhaps this symbolism is even more apparent in the chapel of St. George of the Garter, which is one of the great orders of chivalry in England. In the ritual and ceremony of the Garter, as it was practiced in its original form, the knights of the Garter each had a throne in the chapel of St. George. Now these thrones were not the thrones of British monarchs, because over one of these thrones, even during the war, was hung the banner of the Mikado of Japan. Over another was the banner of the Shah of Persia. The great order of the Garter was composed, theoretically and originally, of all of the rulers of men, based upon the great books of Hermes on the deportment of kings. It was a very ancient and mysterious rite. And in the ceremony of the rite, there was a point at which the knights, each of whom carries the mysterious symbolical cruciform sword of the Garter, all step down from their thrones and form the circle,
one stretched forth the point of his sword and overlapped it with the points of the other swords, and out of the combination of these swords was suddenly formed a star of steel as a symbol of the union. And this star, of course, was the star of David, and the star also associated with the star of Bethlehem. It was the symbol of the union of these persons as a living power, producing out of their unity the symbol of the Messiah. This is what would be the Solomonic symbol of the ancient Israel, the shield of David, or whether it is the five-pointed star associated with Bethlehem. The principle involved is that the great light is revealed by the union of lives. And this union of lives is the story of the Messianic dispensation, as it was understood and practiced by the Orthodox Jews. It is a concept which does not find its fulfillment necessarily through a Messiah, although Israel has sought one and waited one for a long time. But more completely, it is this power to create the Messiah, the power to bring together the spiritual resources of the people into one terrific focus, and through this focus, to prove marriage. To prove that the time for the return of the Shekinah glory has come. To prove that even the Maseroth and their forces have predicted that this would occur. The proof that in the midst of this union of people, the Shekinah glory will hover over Israel, and the secret God of Israel, the Archangel Michael, the Cyclops of Heaven, would bring the power of the New Age, the Age of Peace. Men must therefore unite to form this peace. The greater their union, the more perfect the star that is fashioned out of their own souls and out of their own consciousness. And these gathering together save not themselves necessarily, primarily, or even each other primarily, for their glory is to bear witness to the heavens and to the glory of the eternal God. Thus, through the creation of the Merkabah, which is the chariot of power, the mysterious Merkabah of Ezekiel's vision, the chariot drawn by the cherubim, this Merkabah, or the chariot of the eternal, is, of course, the Messianic tradition. This is the eternal city. This is the thing that is built by the secret power of dedication. It is created and maintained and perfected by man's recognition of his duty to God, and not God's responsibility for him. That it is his right and privilege to release the eternal, to bear witness, and to fashion the great day of the Messiah King. And when the Messiah King comes, will it be a person? Perhaps it will, perhaps it will not. Israel is not certain. But what will happen is that it will be the embodiment of the heart of Israel. For the Messiah King will be the living heart within the body of the new way of life. And from its great heart, this power which has been created out of Israel will have one life. It shall have one mind, which is the wisdom of them all. And it shall have one heart, which is the wisdom and the dispensation of the Messiah. And with one heart and one mind, Israel will be one people. Now this refers to their thinking, certainly, the final union of all peoples, and the bringing together the wisdom of the ages and the perfection of the human being. And that is what the story has meant to me, and I hope that it will convey something of the spirit to you, and then we will be ready to go on to another phase of it next week in our study of